Charger Online Podcast. My name is Stella Brewer-Vartanian, and with me today is... Who is it?
It's Peyton!
Oh boy. Alright, Peyton, would you like to introduce yourself a bit?
I'm Peyton. I'm, you know, a recurring character on Stella's podcast, and I'm back again, and I'm so excited to learn more about our good friend Jeffrey Lynn Hand.
Oh yeah, you're going through your redemption arc storyline right now,
oh,
right?
Oh, 100%. I'm so excited.
Can't I actually kind of think it's not written very well, so...
Well, you're the one who wrote it.
That doesn't seem like a me problem. That seems like a you problem.
I agree.
Okay, anyway, it's good to have you back. So today we're going to be talking about Jeffrey Lynn Hand, a convicted murderer and kidnapper who might have also been a serial killer in the Indiana area during the 1970s. This is our second episode on Hand, so if you haven't watched the first one, I recommend you go check that out, because we're just going to launch right into where we last left off.
Okay, I regret saying our friend Jeffrey Lynn Hand now.
You look real, real cool now, don't you, buddy?
See, maybe the redemption arc isn't happening yet.
Yeah, we're the getting villain arc. There. All right, so where we last left off, good old Jeffrey was in prison. So, following his arrest for first-degree murder on June 18, 1973, the crimes against Jeffrey Wayne Thomas, who was black, and Carol A. Thomas, who was white, caused racial tensions between white and black people in the South Indiana area to boil over. The strife became intense enough for several people to start throwing bricks and rocks at the blockaded borders of the crime scene. When this resulted in a woman being injured, Jeffrey Wayne Thomas's brother, Willie, took to the local newspapers to publicly appeal to the white and black community to refrain from any more violence. So, that sucks.
Yeah, that's...
I don't really understand why you would go for the crime scene. I mean, I guess when you're angry, but, like, why the crime scene? That's, like, gonna be what solves this, you know?
Yeah, that's... You know, they gotta take their anger out on something,
yeah.
I guess.
I'm all for throwing bricks at people, just, like, don't do it at the thing that's gonna solve this crime.
Yeah.
Yeah. Alright, so while he was in jail, Hand attempted to hang himself on June 25th, but he was stopped when his cellmates physically held him down until a security guard arrived. Due to this suicide attempt, the court decided to remand Hand to a special cell in the jail to undergo mental health examinations from court-appointed physicians. Hand, however, refused to communicate to anybody, and combined with his transfer to the new cell, his arraignment date was moved back to July 30th. In one of the rare instances of Hand speaking to officials, Hand spoke with Indiana State Trooper Joseph Rhodes. Rhodes, in an interview with the Courier Press in 2019, said that Hand told authorities that he watched a man named Chuck kill Wayne Thomas, and described the man in enough detail for the police to create a composite sketch of Chuck. Hand reportedly told the authorities, "You show that sketch to anyone who knows Chuck, and you've got him." Oddly enough, the sketch looked like him. It looked a whole lot like him, Rhodes said. All information...
It's his twin, guys, don't worry.
It's his doppelganger. It's Foot. Jeffrey Lynn Foote.
Jeffrey Lynn Foote.
Yeah, but, so all information about Chuck came directly from Hand, and the police never found any evidence that Chuck even existed. Rhodes stated that whenever he tried to probe Hand for more information about this Chuck, Hand would become distracted and he'd start rambling about the nightmares he was having about Jeffrey Thomas. Hand said, "That guy never did close his eyes."
Oh, wow. A tiny, tiny bit, spooky, scary, morbid.
Okay. Telltale heart much?
Oh, yes.
So Hand's trial date was pushed back several more times until October of 73. So the prosecutors were pursuing the death penalty for the case, which was actually the first time the death penalty was, being debated since the state, reinstated it. So, the defense team, meanwhile, though, was arguing that Hand was not guilty by reason of insanity. And on the first day of jury selection, Hand noticed a photographer from a local newspaper taking pictures of him through the window of a courtroom door. He then stood up in the proceedings and began shouting at the man to stop taking pictures of him. And I don't have the photo with me right now, but if you look it up online, it's pretty, knowing what he did, it's pretty not fun to look at.
Yeah.
So, when the trial actually began, though, on October 11th, three mental health experts testified for the defense. One of the psychiatrists testified that Hand had been treated with electric shock treatments almost a dozen times, and that Hand was quote-unquote greatly disturbed. The three also testified that Hand, who had been diagnosed as paranoid and suffering from schizophrenia, had been committed to mental health hospital several times in his life and could not appreciate the wrongfulness of his acts. Former deputy prosecutor Stan Levko described Hand's conduct during the trial. I particularly remember one thing during the trial. I remember he had a pencil in his hand, and he broke the pencil. He just snapped the pencil in half. Not that it takes a lot of strength to do that, just, I'm guessing in my career I've never had anybody snap a pencil in half before. It was just a strange thing, but obviously Hand had a lot of this pent-up anger. The trial ended after 8 days, with the jury deliberating in less than 3 hours before announcing the verdict of not guilty by reason of insanity. Thus, Hand was cleared of the murder charge. After the announcement of Hand's acquittal, Levcote told the court that you eventually are going to send Jeffrey Hand back on the streets, and that would give him a credit card for future criminal activity. And sadly, Levcote would be proven correct.
Ominous.
I know.
Foreshadowing. See, I learned something from English.
Yeah. So what do you think? I mean, we haven't gotten super far, I guess, into this episode, and I guess we'll have our first breakdown. But do you think Hand was, like, faking it, so to say, or do you think he was legitimately, like, insane?
I have no idea. And I don't know. I mean... I mean, it seems like everyone is convinced, for sure, that he, you know, he was diagnosed with schizophrenia, and paranoia and things like that. So it seems like definitely the professionals are convinced. So either, you know, he did have mental health issues, or he was just a very good actor, I suppose.
Yeah, I thought the Chuck thing was interesting in that, like, it's not unheard of, like, I'm not saying it's impossible, but, you know, I feel like in the cases I've seen, at least, of people suffering from schizophrenia and then committing a crime, like, they'll say they did the crime, but where that kind of mental health problems come in is that their reasoning for it is, like, off. Like, they'll think the crime is justified, like, they were... a government spy, like, you know what I mean?
Right.
So I don't think I've seen a lot of cases where they're like, oh, no, I didn't do it. Someone else did it.
It was Chuck.
Yeah, so I don't know if that was just... Because, again, that's not, like, impossible. It's just... In my opinion, I think it's just a little unusual. Mm-hmm. So maybe something to raise an eyebrow at. But Hand's trial over Carol Thomas's kidnapping was moved back to a local county due to the publicity surrounding the trial. But while in jail, Hand beat up another inmate so brutally that he was sent to a state prison. Over the next 2 or 3 years, Hand's arraignment for the kidnapping trial was continuously pushed back as Hand's attorney argued to the courts that the kidnapping charge should have been included in the murder charge, and thus the charge of kidnapping should be dismissed. Hand's attorney also argued that Hand's civil commitment papers were not filed properly, and thus this hospitalization was, you know, improper. And eventually the judge agreed with the defense, and in June 1975, Hand's arraignment for the kidnapping charge was waived, and he was again declared not guilty by reason of insanity. Sent to Norman Beatty Mental Hospital in Westville, Indiana, Hand spent a year within the facility before being declared sane and being released back to his family in Washington, Indiana on June 24, 1976, despite there being no ambiguity or uncertainty on whether or not Jeffrey Lynn Hand had killed Jeffrey Thomas and kidnapped Carol Thomas. Jeffrey Lynn Hand was now a free man.
All right, well, I'm sitting here with my mouth open. I know that it took you some time to figure out, like, why he was able to get out, you know, why they just let him go, and I did not think that it was gonna go like that.
Yeah, I don't, like, okay, there's a lot of things I understand with, the justice system. You know, what's the phrase? Better to let 10 guilty men go free than imprison one innocent man? But, God, the cases where, like, these people who obviously have committed a crime get out on, like, a technicality.
Right.
Like, I know for our justice system, we have to have the rules that, unfortunately allow those technicalities, because the technicalities are the exception, you know? But, God, seeing them is, like, so infuriating.
Yeah.
I forget what the, name of the woman was, but, there was, I'm pretty sure, a woman who was murdered by her husband, he went to trial over it for the murder, and he was acquitted. And then, like, a decade later, in the basement of the house, they found photos of him, like, killing his wife. But because of double jeopardy laws, you know, you can't retry him.
Ugh.
So, I'm not a constitutional lawyer here. I don't know how to work around that, but it's just like, how good of a justice system can it be if someone who, like Hand, you know, can get out on the technicality of, oh, papers weren't filed right, so.
Right, and it sounds like they just kind of, you know, put him in that hospital and were like, all right, like, not our problem anymore, mm-hmm. you know? Even when he was declared sane, there was no going back to that, and I'm sure there was things that were preventing them from, you know, doing anything, like, with him again, but just, yeah.
Yeah, and going back to that whole, like, was he faking it thing, like, hey, I don't have schizophrenia, I'm not an expert on this, so if you know I'm wrong on this, correct me, but, like, schizophrenia is a pretty, it's a pretty strong mental health disorder. I don't think you can be, like, I don't think you can be going from, I watched a man kill a person and kidnap another person, to, I am sane enough to be released back to the
yeah.
public.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know, I want to have faith in the psychiatrists and that they weren't, like, you know, being fooled by this guy, but I don't know, either, for me it's either, like, Hand was faking it and he was like, oh, I'm suddenly better now, oh my gosh, or, like, or those psychiatrists, like, did not do their job, like, mm-hmm. that is a grave mistake they made right there.
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, unfortunately, Hand was put back in the streets as of June 1973. So, our third theorized murder victim of Hand was Deborah Jane Bennett in the summer of 1976. Deborah Debbie Jane Bennett was born in Dodgeville, Wisconsin on July 22, 1955, to William and Marie Bennett. With her brother and three sisters, she was raised in Ridgeway, which had a small population of about 450. Bennett was described as a free spirit, and that she found it easy to talk to anyone. She stood at 5 feet and 5 inches tall, and when she was 8, she fractured her collarbone, and that'll come into play later.
Okay.
Bennett apparently found life in her small town too quiet, and so 2 years after graduating from Dodgeville High School in 1973, she moved to nearby Madison, Wisconsin at the age of 20. Her online obituary said that while there, she found work and began making friends. However, Bennett's life was not entirely without trouble. In June of 1976, she was arrested as a suspect by Madison police for burglarizing an apartment on William Street. She was never convicted, however, and was soon released. Available information on who Bennett was as a person is unfortunately rather sparse, but the details surrounding her death are much more clear. So, 7 months into living in Madison, on July 8th, 1976, Bennett was unemployed and had been evicted from her apartment that she had been living in for the past 5 months. She had rented a room at the Cardinal Hotel in Madison, though she hadn't had a chance to move in yet, and I thought this was interesting. So the Cardinal Hotel was actually, later would become a hub for Madison's Cuban and LGBTQ community, and its owner, Ricardo Gonzalez, was the first gay Latino elected to public office in the U.S. in 1989.
Really?
I just thought I would bring something nice and
no, right.
interesting to a horrible, horrible discussion topic.
Well,
so, good job, Gonzalez! Thumbs up! So, perhaps to move into a rented room at the hotel, Bennett began to walk north towards the hotel in the evening. She was last seen wearing blue jeans and carrying a denim jacket and a brown shoulder strap purse, and she was walking barefoot. Unfortunately, this would be the last time Bennett would be seen alive. On July 21st, only one day before her birthday, Bennett's body would be found in a ditch along Old Sauk Pass Road in Cross Plains by two land surveyors, which is about 10 miles southeast of Madison. Her body, which was found in a so-called party area, was badly decomposed and burnt to a point that she had to be identified by dental records and her fractured collarbone injury from when she was 8 years old. Officers found that her body and the weeds around it were covered in a flammable substance, which would indicate that her corpse had been burned in the area she was found in and that she had likely been burnt post-mortem. An autopsy showed that she had likely been killed 10 days before her body was found, but the cause of her death could not be identified. Unfortunately, Bennett's father died after a battle with a long but unnamed illness 5 days after Bennett's body was found. The two were buried together in Eastside Cemetery in Dodgeville after a joint funeral. Oddly enough, 3 weeks after her body was found, her key to the Cardinal Hotel was mailed back to the hotel, but it seems that the officers were unable to track down the sender. So.
Hmm. That's too bad.
I feel so bad for that family. Imagine losing...
Oh, yeah.
Like, for the mom. Imagine losing your husband and then your kid, like, in less than a week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's awful.
I mean, shoot, I get, like, a C+ on a math exam, and I'm crippled emotionally, so I don't... I can't really imagine what that's like. But the key thing, what do you think of that?
I mean... At least he was considerate, I guess.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, definitely taking a risk mm-hmm. in doing that. I mean, obviously nothing came of it, but, I mean, I guess maybe, I mean, if it was Hand, because we...
Yeah,
this we're just not a suspect. Sure. Okay, yes. You know, maybe he just didn't want that evidence tied to him, so he got rid of it.
Yeah, so if he was, like, arrested or anything, they couldn't be like, hey, what's this?
Right.
So if you remember with the Pamela Malam case, which we know he did, you know, he disposed of her body by just putting it in the trunk, which is a pretty, you know, brazen move.
Mm.
So I'm not really sure if, like, what you said, where it's like, almost like a naivety about, like, you know, just sending it back or whatever. So I can't tell if it was, like, you know, just like a way to kind of remove some of the evidence, or if it was just like a I'll just mail it back, they won't know who I am, or if it's like an arrogance thing of like,
right,
like, you know, here's your card back.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
so that's the thing again, like, with is Hand legitimately, you know, schizophrenic, paranoid, whatever. Are these crimes really a result of his, you know, mental illness, or are they a result of just, like, being a bad person, you know
yeah.
what I mean? And using that as a cover. So, let's move into some reasons that point towards Hand as the culprit. So, first of all, Indiana State Police have said that they're looking into the possibility that Hand might have been involved in a Wisconsin homicide. But which homicide they are referring to, and why they would be looking into the homicide, have not been revealed to the public. Seeing as Bennett was murdered in Wisconsin at a time that Hand theoretically would have been free, Bennett's death might be the one that investigators are looking into. And why I chose Bennett's death, or I believe that might be the Wisconsin case, is that Bennett matches up with a lot of the characteristics of, Hand's confirmed victims and the victims that, are theorized. You know, she stood at 5'5", she was slender, she was white, she had light brown hair, and the way she died is unknown. And her corpse being left on the side of the road in a ditch is another shared characteristic, with most of the victims I've discussed, you know, leaving them in the side of the ditch, or in the side of the road. Vicki Lynn Harrell was left on the side of the road, Wayne Thomas was left on the side of the road, Deborah Jane was left on the side of the road, and a case we'll talk about in this episode, but we haven't talked about yet, Harmeyer, a girl named Harmeyer, that's four people, that were left on the side of the road in a ditch.
Yeah. I do wonder why her body was burnt, if that was kind of trying, again, to, I'm doing air quotes, obviously the people can tell, like, get rid of the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously it didn't work, but that's, again, just an interesting detail.
Yeah, and sorry to interrupt, but I mean, I'll talk about that too, is that, like, you know, Hand didn't burn any other bodies.
Right.
Like, if he did this and he did these, mm-hmm. you know, come along with us, dear viewers, and our theory. But, you know, he didn't do that for anyone else. So, you know, if he was, like, trying to be careful and everything, like, I just got out of jail, prison, I need to be, you know, careful now and everything, why would you burn one body and then be like...
Right, or again, was it just, like, if it was him, in mm-hmm. our theory, was it him just being like, oh, let me do this? Like, randomly. Like, let me just...
Yeah, like, was it a product of a delusion?
Mm.
Well, it might have been, like, I was thinking about... I mean, of course, I'm the one who made the theory, so I'm the one that's wearing the tinfoil hat saying, it's all real! But, I mean, it could have been that he kills Bennett, burns her body, you know, doesn't get caught. And so maybe he's like, all right, things are back to normal now. I don't need to, like, you know what I mean? Like, he gains the confidence where he doesn't feel like he needs to dispose of the corpses or hide any evidence.
Mm-hmm.
So, kind of going into what I said, there are plenty of reasons why Bennett might not have been a victim of Hand. With details on Bennett's case being so sparse, the evidence necessary to tie Hand to her homicide is basically unavailable. To say that my evidence for this theory is circumstantial is, you know, being kind. And though officers are investigating a case in Wisconsin, that doesn't change the fact that Madison, Wisconsin is 408 miles, almost 6.5 hours away from Hand's home in Washington, Indiana. After being incarcerated for 3 years, you know, he might have been paranoid of being caught, and so, you know, he went far, far away to commit a crime, and, you know, he disposed of the evidence, but that kind of is a level of foresight that I feel like Han didn't possess in other crimes, you know? And there's kind of the paradox, right? So if he's impulsive enough to where he has to kill, because if you notice, Han was released in June 1976, Bennett was killed next month, mm-hmm. in July. So, okay, if he needs to kill that bad, he's got that impulse, you know, it's like, how does he display the self-control to drive 6 hours away,
yeah.
and, you know, burn a corpse? And if, you know, he is being, you know, self-controlled and everything, why wait only 1 month after you're released, you know? And like we said before, the final discrepancy is that Bennett's body was burnt post-mortem. That is a unique factor, I guess, in all of the victims and the people we have mentioned. No other person's body was burnt.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, again, perhaps Han, like, you know, burned her for get rid of evidence, but then he sent the key back, which, again, might just be ignorance and or arrogance, but nonetheless, it's still kind of like, the whole case is kind of this weird, whether he was being self-controlled, or, you know, he was in control of himself, or he was being impulsive, like, you can't really choose one and have the narrative make complete sense.
Right.
You know? But 46 years after Deborah Jane Bennett's death, her homicide is still unsolved. Both of her parents and one of her sisters are now dead without knowing what happened to their daughter. Information and attention on Bennett's murder is so sparse, in fact, that I was unable to find a specific number to call if you have any potential information about her homicide, but I would recommend calling the Dane County Sheriff's Office at 608-284-6800 if you have any information about Bennett's homicide. Alright, so now we're going to move into our fourth theorized murder victim, who is Margaret Ann Hayes, who went missing, actually, in March of 1977 in Bloomington, Indiana. So, nicknamed Margie, Hayes was born on December 30th, 1954, woo, go Sagittarius's, described as quiet in the Indiana Star. Hayes had brown hair, green eyes, and a slender build of between 120 and 130 pounds. Standing at 5 feet and 5 inches, she was very nearsighted and wore contact lenses, but apparently could only wear them for a few hours at a time. You wear contact lenses. Can you only wear them a few hours at a time?
Well, okay, the thing is, I'm lazy, so I'll leave them in for like a week straight and I won't take them out. But it's painful. I don't blame her. They're not fun.
Gonna get cataracts at like 25.
I know.
I'm gonna have to like...
But I'm lazy.
True.
You can guide me.
That is true. I can. Dude, you can get like a service dog.
Right?
Free dog.
And take him to the airport.
Oh, that's all. Yes.
Yeah.
Do you think he would make friends with, like, the airport dogs that, like, sniff for drugs?
I think so. I think they would be best friends.
Narc. Well, anyway, so Hayes' loved one stated that she was the type of person who would be unlikely to get into a stranger's car. Hayes was 22 years old and a student at Indiana University in Bloomington. At the time of her disappearance, she had completed 7 semesters and was majoring in social services. However, she was unsure if she wanted to continue studying social services or if she wanted to take a semester off to choose, you know, a different major. But to pay her expenses, she worked 3 days a week as a housekeeper. And Hayes' family, who lived in Fort Wayne, last saw her in person in January 1977 and spoke to her over the phone on February 10th. It would be the last time they would hear from her ever again. On March 10th, Hayes left her home at the 700th block of Atwater Street around 11 p.m. to go to a Caveat Emptor Street store to buy cigarettes. So that's like a general store. I looked it up. It's like a Starbucks now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Anyway, the store was only 4 blocks away, so Hayes left on foot, wearing blue jeans, a navy blazer jacket, and a short-sleeved red, blue, and beige sweater. She left only with $13 in cash. Her apartment was left in an orderly condition, with all her clothes, luggage, her checkbook, her IU student ID also was left behind. Hayes left her apartment and was sadly never seen again. So, I don't think she left on her own, like, because, you know, I was thinking, alright, well, she didn't know what she wanted to do with her future, it seemed like, but that's the thing, though, like, I mean, sure, but who just says, I'm taking $13 and my dreams, you know, like,
yeah.
So, what do you think?
I mean, I completely agree that, I mean, it would... You know, again, it would make sense, like, more sense, at least. Like, oh, she took, you know, a good amount of money. She took, like, some
she
clothes.
She took a suitcase,
yeah,
you know.
Like, okay, yeah, for sure. But, yeah.
Like, I don't want to criticize the cops who are, like, working this case, but, like, some of them were like, you know, maybe she just left, you know, because she was unhappy. And it's like, who leaves? Like... You know, who's like, gee, I don't know what major I want to go into. I'm going to run away from my otherwise loving family with $13 cash. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
So I unfortunately don't think Hayes is alive. You know, whether that's due to a, you know, homicide or due to like an accident or whatever. You know, I don't know, but I don't think she's alive. But to begin our reasons why Hayes might have been killed by Hand, Hayes, again, fits into the physical description of some other victims that we think might have been killed by Hand. She was white, she was young, she was petite, and she had brown hair. And also, like, two of the theorized victims, and one of the confirmed victims, Hayes was a college student. And in fact, she attended the same college as another theorized victim. To say the least, she fits this... how should I say, potential modus operandi, you know?
Yes.
And also the case for Hayes simply deciding to leave, as I said, is pretty flimsy. Again, hey, I'm not going through it, so maybe it was really affecting her, but I don't think, gee, do I want to study this or study that is enough of a reason to be like, I need to run away and I need to do it right now.
Right, and having, she already had, I think you said 7...
semesters.
Yes, under her belt, you know.
And also, she was and still is classified by law enforcement as endangered missing, which suggests a level of foul play in her disappearance. So like I said, I unfortunately don't think she's alive. I mean, if she listens to this podcast for some reason, it's like, hey, that's not true. You know, hey, that'd be pretty cool. But I think for whatever reason, she is swimming with the fishes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But again, there are some reasons, though, against my theory here. It's that, I mean, again, like with Bennett's case, completely circumstantial. Honestly, my case kind of just sums up to, like, she probably didn't want to leave on her own. She was a lot like these other women that, you know, disappeared or were murdered, and she was in the same area. So, I mean, that's nothing to really write home about,
but that's,
you know?
The thing, there aren't a ton of details about it, so stuff like that, you know, that's what you need to consider.
Yeah.
And also, just, like, a round of applause. Like, I don't know if the podcast people... If anyone listens to this podcast,
all
I hope
two of
so.
You.
Yeah. But Stella literally spends like weeks and weeks, you know, doing all this research and compiling these theories, by herself. And you come up with all this stuff, and you're the one who makes these connections. And, you know, you work really hard on it.
Well, thank
you,
man.
It's...
Well, I mean, I don't really have a choice. Mr. Beckley locks me in the school basement, and he doesn't let me out until I finish it. But, you know, I do try. I do try.
You would make a very good private investigator or something like that.
Aw, thank you, bro. Well, here's the thing, though. I don't like doing actual work. Like, I'm just sitting here, you know, in my little spinny chair saying, I think this happened, but like, I'm not doing any actual like research.
But you did put effort into it.
I did try.
And you did so good.
I deserve a gold star.
You do.
All right. So again, another fact against my little conspiracy theory is that just because Hayes is endangered missing doesn't mean necessarily that she was murdered or she's even dead. Perhaps, you know, she... Well, I guess what I should say is people have left, you know, their old lives suddenly for, you know, weirder reasons than Hayes. And, you know, we're sitting here like, that's not, you know, the major uncertainty. That's not a reason to be anxious. But, you know, maybe for her, it was.
Exactly.
You know, it's kind of hard with these cases to be like, that's unreasonable. That's suspicious with, like, people's behavior. Because, like, there are plenty of things I do that would look totally suspicious if I was accused of a crime. Mm-hmm. But I'm, like, I haven't. I'm just kind of a weird dude. I you know,
you sure you're not trying to cover up your tracks?
Yeah. Mm. I'm Jeffrey Lynn Hand, actually. Case solved. But anyway, Hayes' whereabouts still have not been uncovered, but if you have any information about her disappearance, you are asked to call the Bloomington Police Department at 812-349-3319. Alright, so our fifth theorized victim of the day is the homicide of 20-year-old Anne Louise Harmeyer in September 1977. Harmeyer was born on August 27, 1957, in Newcastle, Indiana. Sadly, Harmeyer's father died in 1962 when the Harmeyers were 4 years old, and so her mother, a music teacher at a middle school in Martinsville, was left to raise her on her own. Harmeyer attended Lincoln High School, where, in her senior year, she played the lead role of Nellie Forbush in her school's production of the musical South Pacific. I thought that was like a typo when I looked it up originally, but apparently it is a musical. Oh. So you learn more
about the ocean.
I know, right? Why not North Pacific? Ha ha. Very, very funny. Anyway, in 1974, she competed against 16 other women in a beauty pageant and won, being named the Whitewater Canal Day's Queen.
Wow.
Literal queen. Anne's second cousin, Scott Burnman, stated, I tell people that Anne was the nicest person who had the worst thing happen to her. Charming, funny, and beautiful, my 20-year-old cousin had a sparkle about her. But her kindness and generosity are the reasons why her family and close friends tear up when they talk about her to this day. Harmeyer attended the Indiana University in Bloomington, like Hayes, where she was admired by her friends and her faculty as, quote-unquote, a talented actress who worked hard at her acting craft and studies. An honor student, Harmeyer stood at 5 feet 5 inches and weighed in at 106 pounds with light brown hair and brown eyes. Harmeyer's bright life, unfortunately, would come to an end, though, in 1977. After visiting her family in Martinsville, Indiana, Harmeyer drove southbound back to the Indiana University campus on September 12, 1977. Her rust-colored 1971 Pontiac Le Mans ran into car trouble. It would later be found that the car had overheated, the engine radiator was out of water, and the car had a faulty thermostat. I know nothing about cars, but I assume that is not good. Harmeyer was last seen getting into the car of a quote-unquote Good Samaritan, but the details of this Good Samaritan and their car are either not known or not released to the public, which you would think they would, because that seems like a pretty big detail, but whatever. One way or another, when Harmeyer didn't show up on campus for the rehearsal of a theater production, her friends were worried and she was quickly reported as missing. The search for Harmeyer was a national affair, with the media dubbing her as everyone's daughter, and search parties for her being frequent and enormous in number. But despite the attention that the case garnered, Harmeyer's body wasn't found until 5 weeks after her disappearance, on October 18th. Her body was found by a farmer in a 7-foot-tall cornfield, which was 200 yards away from a county road and 4 miles away from where her car would be found. Her car was found locked and empty on the shoulder of Indiana State Road 37. Her hazard lights were still on. Harmeyer's body was bound by the hands with her own shoelaces. Her other pair of shoelaces were tied around her neck. The culprit raped Harmeyer, then used a hairbrush Harmeyer had on her to twist and tighten the knot until Harmeyer died from strangulation. Despite many suspects being identified and arrests being made, Harmeyer's case has never been solved. And unfortunately, Harmeyer's mother was, quote-unquote, never the same after her daughter's death and died 6 years after her daughter in 1983.
So, okay, this sounds to me a lot more, I guess, brutal than some of the other
cases.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know with, so I guess the quote-unquote problem with, some of the theory I've had is that, so mine is that, it's Barbara Ann Hilton who went missing. So if she died, we don't know how she died.
Mm-hmm.
Vicki Lynn Harrell, I think she was stabbed to death, if I'm correct, which is a pretty brutal way to go.
Yeah.
He killed Pamela Malam then, for sure, and we know that. And he strangled her.
Oh, okay.
Jeffrey Wayne Thomas, he shot and stabbed. That was a very brutal death. And then, as we've talked about today, Deborah Jane Bennett, you know, she was murdered, but we don't know how, because the coroner, like, could not identify it.
So I guess he does have quite a track record of brutal, treatment.
Yeah, of the four people that we know have been one way or another victimized by hand, definitely not a polite guy,
right,
to say the least.
That point is moot, then. Mm-hmm. I retract it. Take it back.
I just forgot we had hot chocolate.
No, I know.
I like bumped my hand against it, and I was like,
I'm gonna take a sip. ASMR.
Oh, okay. Boy. Peyton got way too much hot chocolate, and it's like
It's a little cup. It's...
All I'm saying is, dude, the foresight on that adventure could have been better planned.
Hey. Just, do you...
It's constructive criticism, all right?
Are you jealous because you don't have more? I can't talk. The hot chocolate was too good. It scrambled my brain. Jealous because you don't have as much as me?
No, I have the same amount. It's just reasonably placed within my cup.
What are you hating against my
yes.
pink I Heart NY cup?
Yes, I hate New York.
I've never been there.
South all so the I way, baby. No.
Oh, okay.
God, I hate the South.
Yeah.
And I don't care if, like, 30 years from now I'm, like, trying to run for a Senate seat in Alabama and that clip gets played. I hate the South so much. So much, dude.
Every time I've gone to any southern state, like, for a vacation or to visit someone, it's scary. I see some scary stuff down there.
I know. I don't want to talk to anyone that's like, hi, y'all, you're gonna go down to the diner and get some bacon. Like, don't talk to me like that.
The diner?
Diner. Like, I mean, I don't consider myself a discriminatory person, but if you talk to me like that, hands are getting thrown. Anyway, so Harmar, her case might be a product of hands doing, in that, again, she was a lot like other previous victims, and, you know, I'll say it again. Young, white, brown hair. And slender, too, I guess you could say. Petite, if you will. But what's also interesting, and this is probably the case that, or one of my, I should say, strongest theorized cases.
Mm-hmm.
It's not my own, but, you know, it's definitely, I think, probably the one that has the most evidence for it being due to hand. So, Harmeyer died in a very, very similar manner, to Malam.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she was sexually assaulted and she was strangled at the neck with, a rope material. Though the disposal of their bodies is different, you know, Harmeyer left in a field, Malam put in a trunk. It's also similar in that Harmeyer and Malam were both very popular and beloved students. So if Han stalked his victims, before, you know, killing them, this could establish another kind of characteristic of his preferred type. But I don't know, because some of these cases seem really impulsive. Like, for instance, with Carol Thomas and Jeffrey Thomas, which, again, we know he did.
Mm-hmm.
That was impulsive.
Right.
He didn't stalk them. He picked them up on the side of the road, and that's how
that was completely, you know, split-second decision.
Yeah. So, So it's hard to say, like, okay, is he impulsive? Is he, I see someone, I'm gonna kill them? Or is this, like, a, you know, stalk, like, or is the way he plans, quote-unquote, out his murders just, like stalking and choosing someone and then, like, finding them when they're alone, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's kind of hard because in that, we only know two confirmed murders. We have two cases to look at.
Right.
So, you know, for my theorized cases, I can, you know, say all this stuff and make all these, you know, assumptions, but that's not, you know, that's not really going to get us anywhere. But, the reasons against Hand for this case, though, is that, again, there's no physical evidence that link him to Harmeyer's murder, and evidence is circumstantial. But again, out of all my, like, you know, people, all the people I've selected that I think might have been a victim of Hand's, Harmeyer's the one I feel the most confident in. Mm-hmm. But Harmeyer's relatives have been actually very involved with solving her murder, and have had a very intense social media campaign on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Their account name is @WhoKilledAnne. And that's Anne with no E, two N's. If you have any information about Harmeyer's homicide, you are asked to call the Indiana State Police at 1-812-332-4411 or 1-800-423-1286. Alright, so, drum roll a little bit, please. This is the fun case, because this is the one where this, this fine piece of flaming human garbage, his reign ends.
Yeah.
All right, you ready?
I'm ready.
All right, we're going to discuss Hand's final person that he picked on, which was a kidnapping victim, Susan Matlock Plow. So on the morning of January 24th, 1978, 25-year-old Plow was planning to visit her sister's house in Minnesota in the next few, you know, coming days. And before she left, she realized, you know, this is Minnesota. I gotta get, like, a proper winter coat. So she went to the Markland Mall to do some shopping. So Plow, who was described as a free spirit and overall friendly person, she walked into a store and she noticed a man standing near the door. Mm-hmm. That man was Jeffrey Lynn Hand. Since she was, you know, a nice human being, can't relate, she didn't really think of anything at the time, so, you know, she gave him a passing smile and a little, you know, hello. But she walked into the store, and a clerk working in the department's register named Kathy Graham immediately took notice of how Hand followed Plow into the store. She said in an interview with the Kokomo Tribune, Hand was in the store shopping but was very misplaced, and then it turned into a lingering. And he would pick a tag up, but he wasn't looking at the tag. He was watching Plow.
Oh.
After a few minutes of shopping, Plow left the store and headed back to the parking lot to her 1977 Pontiac Firebird, which is a pretty cool name for a car.
Oh yes, my mom had one of those.
Really?
Yes.
Nice.
I wish
she got rid of it. One.
She did. Yes. Too bad.
Man, with a name like Firebird, I feel like who cares if it's broken down? Keep it.
No, literally.
But Graham watched Hand quickly make a beeline for the young woman, and from the store, she could see him weave between cars before attacking Plow and pushing her into her car. Graham then quickly dialed 911 to report the possible abduction. In the car, Hand told the young woman that he had a gun and a knife and that he wasn't afraid to use either one. He even pulled the gun out just to emphasize his point. He told her that he had just gotten, quote-unquote, burned on a drug deal and had robbed someone. He told her to get to the passenger side and, quote-unquote, act like she was with him. Plow described his demeanor as rattled and frantic as he said these things to her. Hand told her that he wanted to get to South Bend, and so Plow offered to drive him to the nearest bus station, but Hand refused. After a few tense minutes, Kokomo police officer Jerry Castle, who had been called by Graham, drove up beside Plow's car where the two sat. Hand then put the gun away and took out a long knife, placing it underneath his leg. Then, Hand began to speed away in the direction of 17th Street. Castle raced after Plow's vehicle and called for backup. Deputy Vernal Bow, who was off duty at the time, heard the call and decided to provide assistance anyhow, which that is a level of commitment I extremely admire, because, like, for instance, when I get out of school and there's, like, any homework due, I'm at home. Too bad.
Right.
But, thankfully, the winter snow, at the time, it made driving the Firebird difficult, and so after a little bit of, like, a chase, the Firebird slid on a patch of ice, and Hand was forced to stop in a snowbank on State Street. Hand then exited the car, and he began running away from the scene, leaving Plow behind. So, while Castle, attended to Plow and everything, made sure she was okay, Deputy Bow ran after, Hand, who ran into a nearby alley, and Bao was able to apprehend him. So while Bao then pulled out his police radio, and So Bao ordered him to stand in front of the police vehicle, and as he reached for his police radio, Han drew his .32 caliber and shot Bao twice, once in the right hand and once in the left side. Han then ran away, but while slumped up against his police vehicle, Bao managed to shoot at Han, hitting him in the shoulder and puncturing a lung. Upon hearing the gunshots and Bao shouting, "I'm hit," Castle ran after Han on his own. Han began to run down a set of nearby train tracks, and Castle shot three times at him. The third shot hit Han in the back, proving the fatal blow that would end Jeffrey Lin Han's life at 28 years old. Still, Han continued to run and attempted to hide from police by crawling under a stationary freight car where he bled to death alone. In Han's coat pocket, police found a long piece of rope, and in his abandoned vehicle, they found clothing, sock caps, masking tape, bandages, ammunition, an extra pair of sunglasses, flashlights, leather gloves, and most disturbingly, in my opinion, pictures of recently engaged couples clipped from a local newspaper. As for Plow, she was sent to a local hospital, although she had no serious injuries. A blizzard kept her in the hospital longer than expected, however, and she ended up having a quote-unquote guilt-filled meltdown a few days after the incident, as she blamed herself for Han's death. Plow, however, has come to say that she forgives Han and feels sorry for him. She said in an interview with the Kokomo Tribune, "I have a very strong faith, which I know is part of the reason why Graham and Castle were there that day. And I do forgive Han, but I'm sad for him because he was really robbed of the ability to get any help just based on technicalities. He had issues that society did not help him resolve. Instead of helping him, we just turned him right back out to do the same thing. So there was never any doubt in my mind that I would ever question not forgiving him. Never."
Oh my gosh.
What a lady. I am not that mature.
No.
I have held year-long grudges for way less.
And the three heroes in this case.
Right?
You know, like...
Bao, Castle, and Grant.
Mm-hmm. Like, very lucky. You know, very lucky circumstances that, you know...
That's the thing. It really goes to show just how much, like, how important it is to call 911 when you see something happening.
Right. Even if like, nothing comes of it, it's better to be safe than sorry.
Yeah. Like, it really does make me wonder, like, you know, for kidnappings of kids. You know, how many kids have just been, like, taken away by an adult? And people see, like, a kid crying and screaming, and they're just like, oh, kid's throwing a tantrum, or whatever. And then that kid's abducted.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I hate to sound like a boomer, but I think especially in today's generation with, like, social media and, you know, filming everything. Like, you know, you gotta film stuff. You don't live it.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like people are becoming even more, like, passive in taking action with this stuff. I don't know. My point is, people, if you see someone getting attacked, call 911, please. Thank you. But I think it's very fitting how Han died, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Cowardly, alone, you know, crawling under a freight train. Wow, good job, dude. Really smart. But something I think is interesting is, right, when he gets into the car with Matlock's case, he's saying, you know, "I've been robbed, I need money," which if you remember for, wow, yawning, how rude.
I'm sorry.
How dare you.
I promise I'm not bored. I'm just, I'm
better
tired.
Better not be. I'll scream really loud and it'll hurt the viewer's ears. Anyway, but, you know, he gets in the car and he's like, you know, I need money and I need to get here, which is what he did for the Thomases.
Hmm.
So it's just kind of weird to me in that, like, if you're going to kill someone, I don't know why, but it just seems like a weird, like, reason to use. I don't know, like, why go through the process of, like, making up this story if
right.
you're just gonna kill them? Why not? I mean, I don't want to sound crazy, but, or, like, cruel or anything, but why not just hold the gun to them and say, drive?
And
you know?
That's the thing, like, also, you know, she described him as looking kind of frantic while he did all this, and which, you know, would make sense anyway, considering you're abducting someone and you could potentially get caught. I don't think anyone wouldn't be frantic doing that. But it's like, was he planning on this? Like, was he in that mall, like, looking stalking. For a victim?
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of sounds like he was. He was just standing there, but again, mm-hmm. we don't know, and I feel like, you know, there aren't enough details to really be like, oh, yeah, mm-hmm. like, make a direct point about it.
Yeah. Yeah, life is so much easier when you don't kill people. But, oh god, I just hit my mic. Sorry! Anyway, but like we were talking about with Bennett's case, I think how, this encounter with Matlock went, I think that's more of, like, evidence for, Hand being, like, an impulsive, kind of spur-of-the-moment killer, mm-hmm. rather than, like, a collected one. I don't know, though. It's, you know, there's a lot more serial killers than I think people realize in America, because not every serial killer is, like, a... I don't know, the definition for serial killer is actually kind of loose in that, like, you only have to kill, like, I think 3 people to be considered a serial killer. And that's still 3 people.
Only 3?
Yeah, I know, right? But I guess what I'm saying is, you know, when we think of serial killers, we think of, like, the worst of the worst. Mm-hmm. You know, Night Stalker, Jeffrey Dahmer, stuff like that. But, yeah, I guess it's kind of sad because, you know, true crime, right? It's become kind of a form of entertainment. And in some way, I think that's all right. But, you know, right, it's the most gruesome, the most tragic cases that mm-hmm. get the most attention. And so, you know, it's like a lot of these cases I've described, in a way, they don't really stand out in a sea of, like, so many crimes against young women, you know?
Right, and it's just, it's like just looking at Hand, one of so many serial killers. I mean, all these people that he's impacted, you know, his victims directly, and their families, their friends, everyone yeah. who knew them, the people who even just lived in that area, you know, hearing about it, like, the amount of people that are impacted, and, you know, no one knows about it.
Yeah. And the thing is, too, even if every victim that I said, I think Han might have been tied to this, even if I'm wrong about all of them, he still killed 2 innocent people mm-hmm. and kidnapped, again, 2 other innocent people. So, you know, when we were proposing this idea to Mr. Beckley, he was like, oh, I don't think, you know, it might be liable if, you know, you're accusing this person of stuff. And we're like, oh, no. He's a bad person. Like, don't worry. This we're not accusing some, like, random Joe. Like, this is a bad person.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just sad how, like, the quote-unquote normal or, like, unentertaining cases of murder aren't really given the same amount of attention. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I don't want to sound, like, holier than thou. Like, I do it, too. I'm not gonna lie. I mean, obviously, the cases where people, like, disappear or are killed in, like, super weird ways. I mean, you know, of course it's going to catch your attention, but, you know, it's sad that some of the more, like, mundane ones, though, kind of right. go ignored, in a way.
And that's the thing, I think, I mean, it depends on the person and how much you consume that type of media, but, you know, you do get desensitized to it.
Yeah.
And I think that, maybe, like, in this day and age, and I guess maybe always, I mean, if you look mm-hmm. 30 years ago, it probably wouldn't be any different, but, you know, it's just, you hear about it and you're like, oh, that's sad. Like, yeah. I'm sitting here and I'm like, oh, that's sad.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like, you really take some time to think about it, and it doesn't really matter how gruesome it was. It's like, you know,
Yeah.
Someone died.
Exactly. A death doesn't need to be entertaining to be tragic, per se. Yeah, like, in the same vein, like, with school shootings, we had, like, what, 4 happen over Easter weekend?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, like, and I'm not, like, how do I say it? I think, of course, the news kind of has a problem with, like, sensationalization? What am I talking about? Sensation, I think.
Yeah.
Or, like, hysteria, I guess. You know, like, broadcasting maybe too much of a school shooting and giving the shooter, you know, more attention. But, like, you know, I remember in 2018 when the Parkland shooting happened, that was, like, all that was on the news for a week. And now we get, like, a 2-minute segment of, like, oh, by the way.
Right. You know? It's so, like, I had no idea. I mean, I don't watch the news regularly or anything, but, you know, I had no idea that there were shootings until I come into this class, and Mr. Beckley was like, oh, you guys hear about the shootings? I was like, no.
Right. You know?
Right.
Yeah, so, I, how do I say it? I have faith, or I have hope, I guess, in some of these cases being solved. Some of them, I don't know, like, missing persons cases, that's hard enough, because you gotta, like, identify where they are, and then if they're dead, you gotta find out how they died.
Right.
And then, you know, if it was foul play, who did it? But for cases like Harmeyer, Vicki Lynn Harrell, I have faith that those will eventually, I think, be solved.
Mm-hmm.
Harmeyer's especially, since her family is so dedicated, you know, to finding out who killed her.
Yeah.
So, we're reaching the conclusion. Peyton, do you have anything you'd like to say?
Just a round of applause for you for
thank you.
All your hard work, and thank you for having me.
Oh, of course. So after his death, Hand was buried in Bethany Cemetery in Washington, Indiana. And over the course of this podcast, we have covered the crimes, confirmed and speculated, of Jeffrey Lynn Hand. We have reviewed the two murders and the two kidnappings that he has officially been tied to, and we also reviewed five women that we believe may have been victimized by Hand. Now, as we end the podcast, I'd like to repeat the names of all the murdered and missing people mentioned today, and the numbers to call for their cases, because, you know, at the end of the day, they're the people we should remember, and the ones mm-hmm. we should keep with us, not Hand. So, Barbara Ann Hilton, born 1949, disappeared August 4th, 1972, in Montrose, Illinois. If you have information, call the Effingham County Sheriff's Office at 217-342-2101. Vicki Lynn Harrell, born 1947, disappeared on August 12th, 1972, in Spencer, Indiana. If you have information, call the Indiana State Police at 1-812-332-4411 or at 1-800-423-1286. Pamela Gail Malam, born May 9th, 1953, murdered September 15th, 1973, buried in Mount Pleasant Cemetery in Terre Haute, Indiana. Jeffrey Wayne Buffalo Thomas, born 1952, murdered June 17th, 1973, buried in Oakville Cemetery in Evansville, Indiana. Carol A. Thomas, born 1954, escaped and survived June 17th, 1973. Deborah Jane Bennett, born July 22nd, 1955, murdered on July 8th, 1976 in Cross Plains, Wisconsin. Call the Dane County Sheriff's Office at 608-284-6800 if you have any information. Margaret Ann Hayes, born December 30th, 1957, disappeared March 10th, 1977. Call the Bloomington Police Department at 812-349-3319 if you have any information about her disappearance. Anne Louise Harmeyer, born August 27th, 1957, murdered September 12th, 1977. Call the Indiana State Police at 1-812-332-4411 or at 1-800-423-1286 if you have any information, or visit at Who Killed Anne with two N's and no E on Twitter. Susan Matlock Plow, born 1952, escaped and survived January 24th, 1978. Thank you everyone for listening.